Hey, Immigrantly listeners, welcome back to the Immigrantly Hive. Before we begin today's conversation, a gentle reminder, if you haven't downloaded our new app, Belong on Your Own Terms, please do it after this episode. Just head to studio.com/Saadhya, S-A-A-D-I-A. This app is my love letter to first and second generation immigrants, a space to reclaim all the layers of who we are without apology, without boxes and dilution. It's a quiet reminder of our personhood, our contradictions and our wholeness. Also, let me know what resonates, what doesn't, and what you would like more of. And you know what? During this holiday season, use it as a gift to you. Because a lot of times we think about what we are going to buy for others, but this app truly is a gift to self. And now to today's episode. I often joke that I interview more authors than anyone else I know. But really, it's not about authorship as much. It's more about who gets to tell stories and how they choose to tell them. Sitting with a writer, listening to the way they braid memory, imagination, and lived experience, it never stops being rewarding. Today, I am joined by Karen Jensen, whose memoir, The Strength of Water, chronicles her mother's journey from working in a Chinese laundry in 1920s Detroit to being sent back to a village in China, then navigating return, survival, racism, and reinvention. As a Chinese-American woman, Karen weaves history, memory, migration, and identity into a vivid portrait of immigrant life. Incredible. I'm excited to hear how she approached the project, what she discovered about family and self, and how stories like hers reframe what it means to belong in America. And to be honest, as I was talking to Karen, she brings such tenderness and clarity to the immigrant experience that feels both deeply intimate and universal. So without further ado, let's dive right in. How are you doing, Karen?
I am well. Thank you for having me and for what you're doing for the immigrant community.
Oh, thank you. You know what? Right before the interview, I changed my setup. So normally I sit in a different place. And I've been thinking about how do I feel more comfortable when I'm interviewing folks? I was like, okay, maybe I should sit somewhere else in a more comfortable chair. And I took that leap of faith today, and I just decided to sit where I'm sitting right now, which to me is interesting because sometimes we plan things and things happen a certain way, and sometimes we just do things spontaneously. And I want to really pivot to your book. What made you feel that your mom's story needed to be told, especially by you?
Well, throughout my childhood, my mother told me stories of growing up in her father's Chinese laundry business during the infancy of the automobile industry in Detroit in the 1920s and 30s. And then later in a Cantonese village on the eve of the Sino-Japanese War. And she spoke of what it was like to survive as a live-in domestic worker and a teen waitress in mid-century California. And these were tales Dickensian in their pathos of those who take advantage of the poor, of family addictions, painful racism, wartime privations, the perils of marrying too young and then feeling trapped in marriage by social pressures. But there were also stories about the strength of family, the kindness of strangers and the power, as she put it, of fighting for your little slice of happiness in this world before you pass on. And along the way, she revealed history from fascinating perspectives. A woman's perspective, an immigrant daughter's, and a life on the margins. And for me, the stories felt mythological, so far removed from my vanilla, comfortable, middle-class upbringing in the San Francisco Bay Area. I grew up in an upper-middle-class town in a two-bedroom house next to a mansion so large that it extended from one street to the next, making me feel like Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby. And how had this transformation happened in a single generation when my mother had not even had the chance to finish high school? I wanted to record that journey from living in little rooms behind a laundry business and then living in third world conditions in China and then returning to mid-century United States. And then how did she progress from there? So that was really my motivation.
But why you?
Oh, well, because she had been telling me these stories since I grew up and I was inspired by them. My life was so different and I was looking, how is this just one generation away, this completely different experience? And I just found it so inspiring how she had made her way. Anytime I feel like my life is getting hard, I go, oh, no. I have a ready-made reminder that no, my life is first world. And any problems I have are really a privilege to have.
So Karen, for listeners who may not be familiar with your mom's story or may not have read the book yet, can you just give us an overview, a snapshot of sorts of your mom's life from Detroit to a village in China, her return, and then, you know, this resilience, commitment, grit to survival?
Well, as a little girl in Detroit, she was standing on a box in her father's laundry business. By the time she was seven, ironing clothes and folding laundry and having to endure racist taunts on the playground. And at the same time, trying to reconcile what passed for normal all around her in 1920s, jazz age, roaring 20s America, which was really a cultural upheaval. All that time, women wearing long dresses, and then suddenly now they're showing their legs and they're cutting their hair short and dancing to jazz music. And reconciling that with her father's vastly different cultural values. In his mind, Chinese women were just morally superior to American women. For one thing, American women sometimes divorced their husbands. There was no such thing as getting divorced where he came from. Sometimes he saw women and men embracing or kissing or something like that on the street, and that was like almost animal behavior in his mind to be doing that in public. And so they thought of them as very loose. He might admire American wealth and business and all of that, but morally, it was not a place that he admired.
This is such an interesting point because I think that's a through line that we see in immigrants even today. Immigrants coming from certain cultures who have this so-called moral dilemma of they want to distance themselves from the moral degradation, as they may see it, in American society. But then what appeals to them is the capitalistic side, the success, the myth of American dream. And I am really intrigued to see that it was happening in the 1920s, but we'll go back to the story.
So another aspect of the story that has always moved me is the degree to which the women of my family were so subject to the social constraints of the time. My grandmother, her dream was to be able to go back to China at some point and see her family. But to do that, she felt she had to bear a son because that was her role in the family, was to produce the heir. And she kept having girls. So despite declining health, despite chronic health conditions, which would have led anyone nowadays to say, I need to stop having children, she kept having children, 5 girls in a row, and also one stillborn. Finally, the 6th child was a boy. She wanted to have that. There was even a term for it, your birth of son happiness. She wanted to be able to go home to her village, to her in-laws, and proudly share her birth of son happiness. But sadly, shortly after her son was born, she passed away. So here is my grandfather with 6 children, 2 still in diapers. And how was he going to keep them together during the Great Depression? His solution was he borrowed some money from in-laws and he took the entire family back to China, to his village, and got a new wife through a matchmaker, a new 21-year-old wife.
How old was your grandfather at the time?
He must have been in his 30s. And I have compassion for this woman as well, my step-grandmother, because she was tricked into that marriage.
How so?
The matchmaker told her that he only had 3 children and he had 6, and all the children were kept away from her until after she was married. And once you were married, that could not be undone. And my aunt tells the story that she literally walked in to meet them and she held up a finger and started counting their number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And, you know, of course, couldn't believe it. So in the village, they stepped back in progress 100 years. They had been living poorly, what we would consider poorly in the United States. They were living in a couple of rooms behind this laundry, but they had electricity. They had a telephone. They had plumbing, access to a doctor if they could pay for one. There was none of these in the village. There were outhouses, oil wick candles, communication by letter, and old wives' tales in place of healthcare. And my mother suffered greatly from malaria and also malnutrition, which were only treated by superstitious cures, which in many ways actually made her condition worse. In the middle of this, the Sino-Japanese War broke out, with Japanese soldiers to live off the land, which means to pillage along the way, pillage through poor villages. They could see the faces of Japanese pilots in their Zero planes as they flew so low over the village that, you know, they were banking around the village and they could actually see their faces. There was no social safety net. There was no food bank. There's no soup kitchen. There's no SNAP benefits. And in these situations, people make desperate decisions to survive, whether to try to borrow some money and send a relative to another country, perhaps as an illegal immigrant, hoping they can make some money and send them money, or to become a bridge for them to escape, or whether to sell a daughter into servitude so she can eat and have a home and you have one less mouth to feed, or in some cases, whether to commit infanticide, which has a long history during times of famine. And yet, so often, and this is a reason I was attracted to your show, immigrants are treated like second or third class citizens. And in the case of undocumented workers, people who are actually working for us, as nothing more than lawbreakers and criminals. And, you know, we have these terrible words that we use to describe them when they're really just trying to survive. You know, countries have a right to secure their borders, but people have a right to survive. And when you're looking at those decisions that they had to make, was immigrating illegally really the most terrible thing that they could have done? And And so we peel away their humanity. If we hear about them being mistreated, we sort of shrug and say, well, really, what did they expect? Be coming here illegally, as though it was a decision that we might have made and chose not to.
Not everybody has legal pathway to citizenship or to coming to the US. Look, people who have come through legal pathways, I can tell you it's extremely expensive and it takes a while. It took us almost 11 years to get citizenship. So this whole notion of, oh, you should come legally and everything will be fine, there are so many guardrails around that as well. But Karen, I want to go back to your mom's story. So how did she escape that situation and return to the United States?
My grandfather left his children with his new stepmother in the village and returned to the United States to work and try to pay down the debts. He had borrowed money to get them there. He had borrowed money to pay the medical bills of his wife before she passed away. So he was paying that down. I mean, these were debts to his family. Then to start saving to bring his family back one or two at a time. So 4 years later, he finally had paid off the debts and he had saved enough for my mother to come back to the United States. She was 16 years old and she came in the middle of a war. She left and came back to the United States alone. And think about everything that could go wrong when you send a 16-year-old alone to another country in the middle of a war. So many things almost did go wrong. But here's what I and also she found inspirational about her story, among many things, is the number of times that the kindness of strangers really made such a difference in her life. So one example is that when she arrived to San Francisco and the immigration officers were checking her paperwork, it was not in order. She did not have everything that she needed. And she said, what's going to happen to me now? They said, we're going to put you in the immigrant detention center at Angel Island. And if you can't get this straightened out, you will be deported. So, you know, a 16-year-old tries to straighten out their own paperwork. And in a panic, before she was taken off, she spoke to the Chinese cook who was on deck. And she said, can you please take a message to my uncle in Chinatown and let him know that I'm here? And he did. You know, this was not something he had to do. It wasn't his job.
But why not her dad?
Well, her dad was...
in Detroit.
No, he was somewhere in San Francisco. She was going to be living with her aunt and uncle. Her father did not have the accommodations to house her at that point.
And she was 16, right? She was probably told that she would be living with them. So she thought that she should reach out to them instead of her dad.
Well, the other thing is that her uncle was a more educated man. And yeah, I actually never asked her why did she choose her uncle over her father. But I can say that her uncle was a more educated man. And he would have been the better choice because he immediately knew what to do. He wired up to Seattle, which is where she had departed the United States, the Seattle immigration office. They wired back down to Angel Island. And within a couple of days, her paperwork was straightened out. And so she was released. But again, just the helpfulness of this person willing to carry a message when it wasn't their job. And that theme is throughout her story, where there are these really critical, hair-raising moments where someone was willing to help out just a little. It didn't cost them anything, but they could give her some advice or they could relay a message. I find that inspirational. That's how she came back. But her aunts and uncles had their own families. They gave her a place to stay for a little while, but then they set her up to be an au pair. So by the time she was 17, she was on her own. Then you hear about in the book the stories of how you're treated in the privacy of someone's home when you're kind of considered that second or third class citizen. And what was that like in trying to survive? And then later she left those situations and became a waitress and was just navigating mid-century life as a young adult woman.
But at some point she got married, she had you. And you talk about the dichotomy or the difference between your upbringing and the kind of life or the lifestyle you lived versus your mother. How did that change come about?
Well, long before she had me, and again, here's another example of my empathy with the condition that she was facing. When she got to be about 20, her aunt was saying, well, it's time for you to find a nest, time for you to settle down, time for you to get married. Despite the fact that she was actually fully supporting herself at the time and had a rental situation and she was fine. But my mother loved her auntie, and she really took this advice to heart. And when her boyfriend asked her to marry, she said yes, not realizing that he was hiding from her an addiction that he had. This was her first husband, not my father. And she didn't find out about that until they were married. And then her life started to be quite unhappy because of this condition. And yet she felt like she could not divorce. I mean, I did ask that question because she lived with this for years and years. And I said, why didn't you leave? And she said, I didn't think my life would improve if I left. She said, in my culture, divorce was a disgrace, leading to social isolation and censure. And it was upon you as a woman to hold the marriage together and to make it happy.
I'm sure at the time it was true for Western society, American culture as well, right? We are talking, what, 1940s, 50s? It was a very different time, even for white women. I think the situation wasn't much different.
Yes, I would agree with that. Because finally, around 1960, she got up the courage to leave. This was 16 years later. And kind of everything that she feared came to pass. Immediately, her Chinese friends are trying to marry her off again because, oh my gosh, you can't be single. You know, what a shame. And then suddenly her coworkers, her American white colleagues, were not treating her with the same degree of respect.
Because she wasn't married anymore?
Right. Suddenly male coworkers were making snide remarks like, oh, I bet that one's hot to trot. Ha ha. And, you know, suddenly she felt, you know, she had always wanted to feel like a lady and dignified. And it really galled her to be talked about that way.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Anyone would. And it just sent her into a depression for quite a while. But fortunately, that wasn't the end of the story. Sometime later, then she met my father as a customer at the restaurant. And I suppose that one might not know this, but I'm mixed race. My father was Caucasian. And the first time he met her, he said he wasn't sure he could get used to her. He was a farm boy from Oklahoma, and he had come to California for better money. He had become a teacher on the GI Bill after World War II. He served in the Pacific Theater. And he said he thought she was stunning, but yet at the same time, she looked so different than the girls he had grown up with that he said, I wasn't sure I could get used to her. Fortunately for me, that feeling passed pretty quickly. And I never said this to him or her. Looking back, I feel like socially conservative Southern culture and traditional Chinese culture have a little more in common than you might imagine.
You're right.
Because neither of them believed in sex before marriage. And so they met in December. They engaged in February. You know, they fell in love and then they married in March and they stayed together for 50 years, over 50 years until my mother passed away. And I think you can't do that unless you're mostly on the same page.
Absolutely.
Which is not to say they didn't have their cultural differences, of course.
I'm sure. And this is such a powerful story, Karen. You know, I was prepping for this interview and I read somewhere you said that you were trying to uncover some of the silences that were ignored or not mentioned in your conversations with your mom. But once you started to interview your mom and your aunts and uncles, a lot of silenced or suppressed memories resurfaced. And I really do want to talk about those details that you uncovered during interviews that maybe surprised you, shocked you, reinforced your understanding of your mom's life?
The most shocking detail that I uncovered, and it wasn't one of those things that she necessarily just talked about casually when I was a little girl, was this idea of infanticide. Because when the third daughter was born, apparently my grandfather said, oh, girls and more girls, and you know, how are we ever going to get ahead? And here they are just on the edge in terms of, you know, finances. We should just put this one under a cover and let her die. And that, coming from our world, is just unfathomable. And I was thinking, where does this even come from? I started doing research and found that infanticide does have this long history during periods of famine. China had been stable for six centuries, and nobody immigrated hardly during that period. But during the 19th century, they got hit with everything. There were wars and uprisings and famines and floods and opium. And then there was this huge immigration, but also there was this period of events like that happening. And I realized my grandfather was born in the 19th century, and I think he was just repeating the survival wisdom that he had heard. Fortunately, just to reassure listeners, he did not go through with that. It was kind of a blowing off steam, I suppose, sort of thing that he said. But still, to even have said it was very shocking to me.
We're right here for every catch-up between classes, for every personal best, for every ambition. Here at Canterbury Christchurch University, you're part of a vibrant community that celebrates every small win and every big moment. That's what makes us fifth in the UK for student experience, based on the Sunday Times Good University Guide 2026. Discover the degree for you at canterbury.ac.uk. Canterbury Christchurch University. We're right here with you.
You know, what I like about this conversation is, although it sounds so outrageous, what you just described, right? You are extending grace to your grandfather, understanding his upbringing, the situation he was in, because a lot of times as humans, we forget that we are a product of our circumstances. The way we view world, the actions we take, the narratives we form in our minds cannot be seen in isolation. And it's not easy. As you said, it's an outrageous thing, but you still were able to extend that grace. Karen, how difficult is it to square the realities of your mother's story with this idea of, you know, humans are different and they are a product of their upbringing and lived experiences?
Well, I guess two things I'll say to that. I am a journalist, so it's my job to see both sides of the story and to report the full picture. But I would say I had experience of that through my mother, because she extended him grace as well. And she had a lot of reason to be very angry and upset with him in through other circumstances of her life. And yet, she chose to look at him as a flawed human being and say, well, he did some good things for me. He did some bad things too. But she looked at how he was raised. His mother had been abusive. And then you look at why was she abusive, and her husband sort of abandoned her. And poverty does not bring out the best in people.
Yeah. So how did your mom's relationship evolve over the years with her dad? Like, were you witness to that evolution at all?
I was not, because by the time that I came along, they had made peace. And in fact, my recollection of my grandparents is that every weekend we would go to Chinatown and take them out for lunch. And sadly, because I suppose my father was white, I never learned to speak Chinese. My mother always spoke English to him, and so I wasn't hearing it so much around the house. But on the weekend, we would take my grandparents out and my mother would be speaking to them and then she would translate between us. But that's still not the same as having a direct relationship with someone. The funny thing is, and here was the negative part of the story. So he brought her over and then here was her aunt telling her, oh, it's time to get married. And so she married on the first offer. And she, of course, wasn't educated. She took work as a waitress, which my grandfather viewed as a disreputable profession. And he sort of was viewing like, well, I brought you over to give you this great chance to marry well. And she's thinking, how would I marry well? But he really scorned her for a while for not marrying well and for being a waitress, which in his eyes was, you know, oh, you're out there in the public as a woman serving people. It's a low profession. Kind of in a way disowned her in some ways. And finally, what brought them back together is that when she had my sister, my older sister, her auntie used that as a kind of pretext to bring them back together. My mom remembered that. She just said, you know, she put my sister into his arms and just kind of saw this armor dropping.
Aww.
You know, just saw the humanity reemerging and just saw how much he was connecting with Stephanie, my sister.
This is so fascinating to me because at least initially the reaction or the relationship that he had with his daughters, and then he falls in love with his daughter's daughter. That's the irony there and then, right?
That is ironic. From there, they started to heal their relationship. She invited him to come and visit and spend time with Stephanie. And through that, you know, through their being able to focus on baby, they could sort of reestablish conversation and connection again.
Karen, you started this conversation by pointing out the differences between your upbringing and your mom's, right? Do you ever feel guilty about the disparity that exists between the privileges in some ways you had relative to your mom? Does that guilt ever come in? Did it ever come in between the two of you?
I wouldn't say guilt, but sometimes in her reaction, I could tell that we did have a different upbringing. Let me try to think of an example. Just as I said, sometimes I would be starting to complain about whatever first world problem I was complaining about. And just by her more calmness about the situation, I would realize, oh, she didn't even have to say it. I know what she's thinking. She's thinking, this is a privilege to have this problem.
And I don't want you to speak for your mom necessarily, but observationally, did you ever feel like she was resentful of what you had and what she couldn't have growing up?
I felt towards the very end of her life that she started to experience some of the sadness, which I think is interesting. I feel like her whole life she had been fighting and fighting. And if it wasn't fighting for herself, then she was trying to get ahead. And then she was trying to build us up so that her daughters could have an education. And there was always something that she was working towards. And so that she, in a way, maybe didn't have the time to even think about the situation. And I thought it was interesting that in the final years of her life, when she didn't have to be fighting for anything, you know, Stephanie and I were fine. We were on our own. She had her home. She was comfortable. In that quietness, some of the sadness came in and she started to think about some of these hard, hard things that she had gone through and to feel sad about it. And that was another reason I wanted to write the story, not only to record it as a fascinating piece of history, not only as a legacy to my daughters, but also to not let that sadness right at the end to be the final word, not to let that be the only thing that we remembered about her story, but to see the whole picture of her story.
You know, I think about this often, some emotions like sadness, anger, resentment, fear itself. As humans, we try to distance ourselves from those emotions, or we try to disown them in some ways, right? We focus on more positive emotions. I don't even want to call them negative emotions. All these emotions really embody our lived experiences and who we are. Why do you think you didn't want your mom's story to have that piece of the puzzle, which you describe as sadness?
It's a good question. And I perhaps should have explored that a little more in the book. I allude to it at the end, but I didn't go deeply into her sadness. It did feel so
uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, but also deeply, almost sacred, deeply private. And I suppose as her daughter, I wasn't sure if she wanted to share that in the end, because in the end, I was finishing the book after she had passed. It is a good question, though, exploring that sadness at the end and some of the regrets. And I guess I can't really describe it further.
Yeah, I was, in fact, going to ask you this, but it seems like this conversation, like at least the sadness part of it, has partially answered it, but I'll still ask. Is there part of your mother's truth that you chose to leave unsaid, other than sadness, out of love, protection, respect?
I can only think of one single incident that I chose not to share. Was something that she shared with me, and I won't share it now. I did leave it out, and perhaps if I wasn't her daughter, I might have included it. I included a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily flattering to her, but I felt she was okay with talking about it and with sharing all of that. There was just this one incident that I left out. And then, as you said, the sadness I allude to, and I do talk about it at the end of the story, I don't explore it deeply.
Were there any visible stereotypes around Asian American, Chinese American immigrant experience that you intentionally pushed back through this memoir?
I don't know if I intentionally pushed back, but my feeling is that we are all searching for a sense of belonging, a sense of how we fit into this world. And I think when you're an immigrant, that journey is so much harder, that journey to find your place of belonging. And that was definitely a motivation for sharing the story, to help people see an Asian American story, an immigrant story, in three dimensions, not as a stereotype, to see the humanity of someone who has lived a very different experience than most of us who grew up here. And I was trying to flesh that out and make it real. And just as I said earlier, to fight back against that sort of those labels that are put on us as just in, or not us, I can't claim to have that label put on me, but against immigrants, you know, like invaders or lawbreakers or criminals, to say, no, there's a lot more to the story. Let's see all the details that make up a human being and what their journey is. So that is a motivation for sharing the story.
Karen, you're a journalist. You look at facts. You present both sides. I wonder if there were moments for you as you were penning down this memoir where you felt internally conflicted between telling a factual situation, a factual truth, or putting an emotional spin on it because you wanted it to resonate not just with the readers, but also to bring out that emotionality of experience for yourself and for others.
Well, Of course, when you're going back through a story that starts in the 1920s, some of the, I guess you could call it creative nonfiction, because I wasn't there with a microphone to hear exactly what they said. So I have to sometimes imagine the conversations and what that must have felt like and put myself in that situation and listen carefully to what my mother is saying and try to get her feeling for it and illustrate it as a drama and not just as this happened and then this happened and then this happened, just as a factual retelling. So yes, I think there's a certain amount of creativity, but the story is intended to be true. I wasn't making up stories that didn't happen.
Right. What do you want people to take away from this?
That each of us is searching for our place in the world, and that's a journey that we each take. And to have some sympathy or empathy for some very different types of journeys that other people take. And to see Asian Americans and to see immigrants as human beings and not as these labels that we have put on them, not as the enemy, not as invaders, and to see them as fellow travelers on the planet.
How has your relationship with the concept of home changed or not changed through this process?
I don't know that it's changed through this process, but I can say that as a mixed race person, I have come to realize that I am most at home in multicultural settings. And being mixed race is a privilege. It makes your world feel larger. To walk with ease in more than one culture makes the world feel larger. I felt at home in my father's family farm out in the Midwest, in Oklahoma. I felt at home in the hustle and bustle of Chinatown. And it's because both of my families loved me. And so I felt comfortable in those places. But yet, sometimes when I traveled between the two, we would take these road trips, these long road trips from California to Oklahoma. And I got out of multicultural San Francisco Bay Area. And sometimes there was kind of a curiosity, which is fine. People would look at me with curiosity because they weren't used to seeing a mixed race person. My parents married in 1963. Bear in mind that this was before interracial marriage was legal throughout the United States. So people like myself were kind of unusual. But then sometimes people would look at me with contempt that I could recognize, even as a child. And I've seen those kind of comments, half-breed, that kind of insult.
What is your response to that?
Oh, I mean, as a child, it felt like, I don't know, like being Harry Potter when his scar suddenly is searing because Voldemort comes close and you just feel the palpable contempt. It's startling. And that's why I say I realized from those experiences that I want to be in a multicultural community, because I never experienced that really in the Bay Area or in other multicultural places like New York. And so that, I think, is what feels like home to me.
In the end, Karen, if you were to define the United States of America in a sentence, phrase, a word, how would you do that?
Ooh, it is a melting pot of the best and the worst of humanity, I would say.
I love that. Karen, where can people find the book? And if they want to know more about you, is there an Instagram handle they can follow? Is there a website they can go to?
So my website is karenkjensen.blog, and Karen is spelled K-A-R-I-N, and then K-J-E-N-S-E-N. And my Instagram is also just Karen K. Jensen. And the book is available wherever books are sold online. So through Bookshop or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Thank you so much, Karen. This was such a wonderful conversation. Thank you for sitting down with me and giving me the opportunity to ask all these questions.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, thank you for what you're doing to lift up the immigrant community.
You know, Immigrantly has this recurring theme. See first and second gen immigrants and their kids in a nuanced way. See their full humanity, three-dimensional identity, rather than boxing them based on what you see in the mainstream media. We keep reinforcing that because, you know what? People still don't get it. This conversation is a powerful reminder of how, as humans, we have similar experiences. We have more similarities than differences. And even if there are differences, we should embrace them as unique traits of humanity rather than holding them against people. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And if you did, give it a review, share it with a friend or a family member, post it on your socials, and don't forget to tag us. Our Instagram is @immigrantlypods. You can follow me on Instagram, where I talk about F1, everyday living, hot takes, my soch, my thinking, @itssadiak. It's itssadiak. And don't forget to check out our app. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. I will see you next Tuesday.